So I think we'll move on to Professor Ward now, who is going to he's done work on comparative theology, he's done work on comparative religion, and he's very well known to you. And I hope that Keith will now do the same thing that he has been doing to Christianity. So, and you can have 25 minutes too.
Good. apologise, I can't get rid of a cough, so I'm just very sorry about that. What I'm going to do is look at the diversity of Christianity. I'm going to assume that surrender to God is a totally central value, but of course how that's interpreted depends on how you interpret God, and God is something important about the divine nature, and God acts through the person of Jesus to enable people to know and love God better. So I think most Christians would say, yes, there are things we agree about. So when I stress the differences, I'm not saying it's just a chaos of different views, but nevertheless, there are some different views. I'm going to mention six. I'm going to do it historically. And I'll say that there are Christians alive today who fall into each of these groups. And of course, there are others that I won't be able to mention. I'll begin with Jesus himself. We don't know much about Jesus himself, academically speaking. But I think I'll just be dogmatic. Jesus was someone who taught that Torah, the law of God, should be obeyed to the letter completely. I won't give any justification for this dogmatism, but I will later if you really want me to. So my interpretation is Jesus was a completely orthodox Jew who taught submission to a Torah, but he did interpret the Torah in a very liberal and humane way. So a characteristic statement is the Sabbath was made for man. Man wasn't made for the Sabbath, which I would interpret to mean, well, you know, there are Sabbath rules, but for example, if somebody is sick on the Sabbath, you can heal them. And Jesus did that, but of course, I need to point out that any Orthodox rabbi would have done the same thing. So that all you need is a humane interpretation of Torah. So the bits that you read about in the Gospels where Jesus was lax in his interpretation of Torah, it's just a liberal interpretation, it's not rejecting it. So here's a sense of surrender, which I think was characteristic of Jesus and his disciples, that obedience to Torah is very important. You actually keep the laws of God. Why? Because you love God and God gave the laws, and that's it. So submission to God has a very specific sense. But I just remind you, the greatest of all the laws was love God. And so that means it's not just servile obedience, it's actually something which involves a passionate personal relationship too. But it is nevertheless obedience to the law. So that's the first stage, and not many Christians now believe that in the exact form, but you still get many what you might call legalist Christians who say there are laws you should obey because they're written down somewhere, and that's the view I'm characterising. The second stage happened almost immediately and in the first generation, and that is the complete rejection of Torah. It is characteristic of Christianity that it now pays no attention to Torah at all, and most Christians couldn't tell you what is written in Torah. Okay. If they said, what are the, by tradition, 613 regulations of the Jewish law, they could only mention about four of them, or possibly 10 as a favourite number. So in this stage, Christians would say, no, we are not bound by law. And perhaps my motto for this comes from Paul, who said, the letter kills, but the spirit gives life. And he also said, Christ is the end of the law. So now surrender to God wouldn't be obedience to written laws at all. And you might well say that you wouldn't obey any law just because it's written down, whether it's in the Bible or anywhere else. Rather, you live by the Spirit. This is a sort of Pentecostalist move, right? You live by the Spirit. You say, surrender to God is letting the Spirit of God, the active, dynamic force of God's love, live in you. The fruits of the Spirit are joy and peace and love and kindness, tolerance, understanding, gentleness. And so you have a sort of characterization of what the spirit would be, but the spirit is conceived as a dynamic force, not at the level of ego, or at the level of what I am doing, but as something that comes beyond the ego, but changes character. So this is about surrender to God, it's about changing your character to become loving and joyful and peaceable as God is. So that's a charismatic view of surrender to God, a living in the Spirit, which is very different, of course, from obeying a law. But Christianity moved on. The next phase I would jump to is the development of theology from the 4th century to the Middle Ages, really, or up to the Reformation. And that development I would characterize in Greek terms, in terms of the Eastern Orthodox Church, as theosis, surrender as theosis. Now, theosis means becoming divine, or sharing in the divine nature. It's not a concept that's totally familiar to all Western Christians, but it would be immediately recognized by Eastern Christians. And it is that, in the words of Athanasius, one of the great early theologians, God became human in order that humans might become divine. And that becoming divine, or sharing in divinity, is another different way of construing surrender to God. It is that your being, your inner self, actually becomes part of the divine self. And that's very deeply rooted in the Orthodox tradition, particularly 4th to 8th centuries. It has a downside, which I'll mention. The downside is that people in this tradition tend to confuse the church with God. And they tend to say that becoming a sharer in the nature of God is actually becoming a sharer in this mystical communion of the church, which means obeying what the church hierarchy says. So it can become very authoritarian and dogmatic, and it's no accident that Orthodox Christians were often very intolerant of those whom they called heretics because they disagreed with them. So there's a downside. But the upside of this view, theosis view, is a stress on surrender as actually a transformation of the self. A transformation of the self by becoming consciously part of the divine nature and leaving behind your individual human nature. Again, that's a work of God. Theosis is brought about by God. But it's not in that quite that dynamic way of being filled with the Spirit in a charismatic tradition. It's a more sacramental path that through growing in the community, the church, and through the sacraments, you become transformed, not necessarily in a very emotional way. Well, there's not great stress on emotion. So that's a sacramental form of surrender. You give your being to God through the sacraments of the church, which change your nature by enabling you to participate in the divine nature. And I think the key word is participation. Participation. It's not salvation. It's participation in the divine. Fourthly, the Reformation. Well, Martin Luther changed the intellectual history of Europe and the world, and he changed it with one major thought. And that thought was that every person should come to their own religious beliefs conscientiously and should not obey Orthodox authorities. Of course, Luther broke with the Catholic Church precisely on this issue. Well, they threw him out, to be precise. But, I mean, what it came down to was he was claiming the right to criticize all religious authority and to make your own conscientious decision. That, I think, was a major breakthrough in human thought. You are free to criticize any authority, but you must conscientiously, for yourself, follow the path you believe. This entails complete tolerance. It wasn't true that it entailed tolerance in fact, but theoretically it entails complete tolerance if you think about it. Once you allow authorities to be criticized, you yourself are open to criticism. But on a Lutheran view, a Reformation view, there was a completely different definition of faith. Whereas faith in the Catholic tradition had been the acceptance on authority of things that you couldn't work out for yourself. That's almost, you find that in the Catholic Catechism even now, that to have faith is to accept on authority a set of intellectual beliefs, the beliefs in the creed, for example. For Luther, that is not a definition of faith. That is not faith at all. For Luther, faith is a personal trust in Jesus Christ. You don't need the church. You don't need the sacraments. You don't need priests. You don't need any mediator between you and God, apart from Jesus, who is God, on theory, so that faith becomes personal trust. And that's another sense of surrender now, not participation, not being indwelt by the Spirit, but rather having a relationship to a personal manifestation of the divine, God seen in an icon, God seen in a particular finite image in human form, and that becomes a mediation of God to you. And faith is your surrender to that person as the representation of God. So that's a Lutheran version of surrender. And it did involve a slight change in the characterization of God as well. Now, this took some time to work its way through. And the change was that for Lutherans, for that Protestant tradition, God is seen much more dynamically. Lutheran theology is often called the theology of the cross, and there's quite a stress on God's involvement in the suffering of the world. That on the cross, what is shown is that the creator of the universe shares in the suffering of the universe. Well, for the Catholic tradition, that is strictly speaking heretical. And at the Council of Chalcedon in 451 AD, every priest who believes that God suffered in the divine nature was declared excommunicate. In Lutheran church, you're excommunicated if you think God didn't suffer in the divine nature. So there must be a difference between them somewhere. So there's that stress on the sharing of God in the suffering of the world. And what that meant is, of course, that God, there is change in God. God suffers because the world suffers, then God is changing because of what the world is. So a much more dynamic view. I mean, for the traditional medieval view, God is absolutely changeless. There is no change in God. Nothing that happens in the world changes God in the slightest. In the terms that Julius used, God has no parts, and change is a part, so God can't change in any sense. But for a Lutheran, God begins to change. And I think in Protestant Christian theology in particular, I would guess most Protestant Christians now take it for granted that God changes and God suffers. But probably most Catholics don't think that. Although what ordinary people think, I have no idea. I haven't met any for such a long time. So, fifthly, that was fourthly. Fifthly, the great German theology, as it called itself, the theology of Harnack and Ritschl and Schleiermacher, and this was self-consciously revolutionary. Again, been very important for Protestant Christianity. And the German theology is a theology of critical inquiry. It accepts as a key notion the notion of autonomy. I think this is the key. It's the key to the European Enlightenment, really, too, the 18th century thought, the autonomy of ethics. That in ethics, it is immoral to accept any authority. You must decide for yourself. This is taking Lutheranism even further. It's not only that you must decide for yourself which bit of ethical teaching is authoritative acceptable to you, it is that you yourself are going to make up your ethical rules. There's nobody else to make them for you. So that's a very radical sense of autonomy. You're making them up. And in Immanuel Kant, you find this very clearly expressed. The problem then for a Christian, if you're going to be a Christian, Kant wasn't a Christian, really. Hegel was, or said he was, anyway. Harnack was, and Ritschl was, so you've got lots of Christians. The problem is, how do you reconcile autonomy, complete autonomy, you yourself make up the moral principles for your life, with believing in God, who might have some ideas about how you ought to live. So how do you reconcile these? And the way the German theology does it is by saying, actually, we construct the idea of God, too. It's not that it's false. Just remember, we construct mathematical ideas. It doesn't mean they're false. It just means we construct them. We don't get them from somewhere else. We have to work it out. But some of the things we work out might happen to be true. I haven't any idea how you know which ones, but that's another problem. But what the German theologians said is, well, you construct an idea of God, you construct an idea of how you ought to live, and in fact these two are connected. Because the sort of God you will think there is the one who lives according to the principles you have made up. Okay. So there's no possible disjunction between what God commands and what you think is right. Because if you're a German liberal theologian, what you will think that God commands is what you think is right. Because that's how you get the idea of God in the first place. First of all, you work out what you think is right, and then you say, God must be like that. Okay. Well, that is the German liberal theology. So it doesn't mean there is no God. It asks the question, how do you know what God is like? And it gives the answer, you just make it up as best as you can. And the words, I think it's Harnack, though, I don't quite know which German theologian it was, talking about how you find out what Jesus was like, which is a rather similar question. How do you find out what Jesus was like? And said, well, it's like somebody looking down a well and seeing their own reflection in the water at the bottom.
It was said of Harnack,
not by... it's another legend,
is
it? Right. It was said of Harnack. Well, in legend, that's been turned into... statement about that. And somebody certainly did, because I've read it, took the same attributed views of Jesus. I think it occurs in Schweitzer's book on the quest for the historical Jesus as a story. But you look down the well, and what you see is a reflection of yourself, and in a sense, that's what liberal theology was saying, that we don't have a neutral view of Jesus or of God. We tend to make God in our own image, but this is not a defect, it's a necessity. So you make the best of it. You make sure your image is a good one, the best one you can think of. And perhaps I should just say that, of course, in these theologians, like Harnack, and certainly in people like Hegel and Kant, the idea was not individualistic. It wasn't that you, as an individual, make up anything you like. It was rather that when you make a serious moral decision, though it is a decision, there's no truth out there, you're making a decision, you make it on behalf of all humanity, or even on behalf of the whole universe, if you can extend it so far. So it's a serious decision on behalf of the whole of sentient being that you make. And I suppose that's a very widely accepted view within certainly Protestant Christianity. So surrender to God now is not something that contrasts with personal autonomy and deciding on your own way of life. Surrender to God becomes a form of saying you make your own decisions responsibly. Or, to put it as Kant did, you do your duty for its own sake. Nobody else tells you what it is. You decide what it is by asking questions like, what could I will everyone to act upon? What moral principles could I will every being to act upon? So you're making a principled decision, but you're not getting it from authority. For some Christians, of course, that is an abandonment of religious faith because you don't have an external authority. But for liberal Protestant Christians, of whom... there are still millions, I guess. That is a different definition of faith and of surrender. What are you surrendering to? Well, surrender wouldn't even be the right word anymore. It would be making principled decisions and living by them. So you're surrendering to moral truth, yes. And you do think there is a moral truth, perhaps, but you don't think it's being told to you by anybody. Or you don't think you can read it off some text at all. It's a very challenging view, perhaps, but it's a very widely held view in Protestant Christianity. And the last one I'll mention is a development of that, that bit you could call surrender as autonomy, a very paradoxical way of putting it, really. And the last one, I think, you, if I chose a word to describe it, would be surrender as co-creation. Now, the word co-creation does occur once in the New Testament, working with God's sin, God. And the notion of co-creation is that God has a purpose for the universe, and the purpose is given not by religion, but by simply asking what would make for human fulfillment, or for the fulfillment of all life. What would make for the flourishing of all sentient beings? And if you ask that question, it's up to you to come up with an answer, of course, but you assume then that that's the answer, that's God, what God wants you to do, is to aim at the flourishing of all beings. And co-creation is working with God to bring that about. And that is the mark of liberation theology. You know that liberation theology is very strong in Latin America, Germany, there are liberation theologians throughout the world. Liberation theologians can be parts of very orthodox traditions. They're usually in tension with the authorities of those traditions, but I think they're certainly existent and influential. So the idea of now would be, it's an even more dynamic view of God, that God wants the universe, as it were, to be a certain way, and that way calls for human responsibility to make it that way. So this is not a passive surrender. It's not saying God's will be done and I just accept it. It's not that sort of surrender. It's saying God's will is that the world shall be changed and I will help to do it. Okay, so it's a surrender to a very dynamic, positive will. And if you ask how you know that God thinks that, well, again, that's a very complicated question. But a large part of the answer is because I think that's what makes for human flourishing. So this is a distinctively humanistic form of faith. So there are six forms of faith within the Christian tradition, and I think they are all represented by millions of believers, apart from the first one, because there are some Christians who keep Torah and think it's important. There are some, there are thousands, but probably not millions. And they're mostly in America, strangely enough. So I've talked about the diversity, I suppose, but the point behind this is to say, in the Christian tradition anyway, surrender to God is not one simple concept that all Christians agree upon. To say, I accept what God is going to do to me is very different from saying, I commit myself to human flourishing because I believe that's what God wants. It's a very different thing. The difference is symbolized between communities which have communities of purely contemplative monks and nuns and traditions which don't have any at all and which are much more practically committed. And I suppose the two opposite poles would be Orthodox monks on Mount Athos and Quakers in St. Giles. And there you have two strands of Christianity. They look different. They both believe in surrender to God, but they interpret it in different ways. So, I don't know what you make of that, and I'm not telling you where I stand, but even to agree that Christianity looks like that is already to have stepped outside any narrow pigeonhole within it.